The Friars' best player. He's been performing to the max.
He really has all year long, and that's Aaron Maxey.
An outside jumper for Maxey. Remember, this is a guy who had to play center his last 2 years at 6'6", 200 pounds, but he's obviously extended his game now that he's moved away from the basket.
Aaron Maxey, he loves it one-on-one. He is a one-on-one star street baller, and he's passed the World Battleground one-on-one finals. Basket, Maxey, triple teamed, and still got it to go off the glass.
To Maxey, beautiful pass, and that one ties it. That's Aaron Maxey for Providence. Side jumper drops for Maxey. Maxey with the lay-in.
Tipped up and in by Maxey.
Maxey with the rebound, easy as they like. Maxey, triple teamed, and still got it to go off the glass.
Big play by Maxey.
What's up, everybody? Not My House is in the house. This is your host, Eric, and as always, right next to me is my co-host, Zach. Zach, what's going on this morning, my friend?
You know, I'm excited. I got my Providence jersey on. We got a former Providence alumni finally on this show, so I'm stoked, man. I'm just ready to get to it.
Yeah, I can't believe this is our first Providence alumni, but what a great one to have. He had a successful career at Providence and a really good career overseas. He's a two-time NZNBL champion, NBL Best Sixth Man Award winner. He's also Nike Battlegrounds King, and he's a member of the Redeem Team. And this year's TBT, Mr. Aaron Maxey. How you doing today, my friend?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me, fellas.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on the show. We always like to get to know our guests before we start talking hoops. And actually, before you hit record, we're having a lot of fun. So, looks like you grew up in Southern California, which we have a ton of guests. The hoop scene's amazing out there. Can you tell us about your childhood and how the hoop scene was out there?
Yeah, I was born in Anaheim. Lived out there until I was 8, and then moved out to the desert. And lived out there basically for about 20 years before my parents retired. You know, growing up in the desert, it was interesting. I was in Riverside County, Reggie Miller, Kawhi Leonard, Ed Gray, you know, a few of the guys who, you know, made it to the show. But I mean, outside of that, I mean, just a lot of guys from the Inland Empire who, you know, have had remarkable careers, you know, with the IE, you know, even, Byron Russell, okay. You know, and we all know B Russ, you know, for, you know, MJ and everything, but, you know, great guy, handful of other guys, you know, from the area, but, you know, growing up is always about just looking to prove, you know, myself, because I was in the desert. And being out in the desert, you know, there wasn't as many schools. In the grand scheme of comp, you know, I think the comp was definitely a bit lower than Orange County, L.A. County. So I spent a lot of time commuting with my family, you know, going into L.A., going into Orange County, you know, basically, you know, honing my craft. You know, other guys from the West Coast, you know, I grew up playing with Baron Davis, Shea Cotton, Chris Burgess, you know, Corey Benjamin, you know, the list goes on, you know, even football players, you know, playing against, you know, guys like Tony Gonzalez, Chris Claiborne, you know, all those guys were in the mix. You know, even, you know, Iceman's, you know, nephew, Caleb Gervin, you know, he was, you know, just definitely a bucket getter, but there's a lot of guys at that time who are coming out, you know, from the IE. And really just looking to, you know, kind of prove themselves, depending on what school you went to, you know, that would, you know, kind of make or break, you know, your opportunities as far as being seen. And, you know, coming out of Lake Elsinore, there really wasn't anything coming out, you know, from there. There was a guy who came out from the 70s named John Greer, you know, who I never met. I know that, you know, he had had some issues when he had, you know, got to college, stuff like that. But that was 20 years prior to me coming out of school, you know, roughly. So, you know, coming out was a good opportunity, you know, put the IE on the map, put Elsinore, Marietta, you know, Temecula, you know, just kind of that south side of Riverside County on the map. And, you know, that's just what it was. You know, you just went to camps, you went to tournaments, you know, you played against people, formed your brotherhood, and, you know, you hooped. I mean, that's the thing with hoops, you know, it is a brotherhood. The degree of separations, most likely just one. You know, and, you know, if you, you know, had game, people knew that you had game.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things I'm interested in when we talk to our guests, was basketball your first sport, or was like Little League Baseball your first sport, or football? I'm always curious about that.
My first sport's actually baseball.
Yeah.
You know, I still love baseball, and I actually played baseball and soccer growing up. I played basketball in my neighborhood as always a part of my family. I have, you know, older siblings, but, you know, it wasn't until I kind of hit the sixth grade, made this little sixth grade basketball team, that I really started you know, kind of going in that direction, went away from baseball, went away from, you know, soccer. Because, I mean, soccer-wise, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, there wasn't anything in the States.
Right.
So, you know, a few of my friends, you know, who were Mexican or Guatemalan, you know, their parents might have played a little kind of semi-pro, or they might have played some pro soccer. So those were, you know, kind of your better coaches, sure, you know, at the time. And then baseball, we had a couple guys, you know, kind of in the area who were picked up, you know, kind of AAA, AA type deal. But there really wasn't a lot that was coming out of Elsinore. So, yeah, I kind of put down the stick and just, you know, really just gravitated towards basketball.
How much do you think soccer helped your footwork in basketball? You think it did?
I think it helps a lot more than people think. I mean, Hakeem Olajuwon.
Yeah.
You know, he grew up playing soccer, you know, in Africa, and he was saying that it really helped. I think that it does. You know, just the control, you know, being able to control the ball. You know, and even if it's just the basics, just stopping the ball, being able to kick the ball, things like that, you know, really does make a difference for your footwork.
Yeah, I played soccer right around the same time I played basketball, and I always felt like soccer really helped in terms of my movement, you know, for defending, to be honest with
right.
you. You felt right. like stay in front of my guy, and that was mm-hmm. from soccer. Plus the conditioning in soccer is
right.
is no joke at all. So you
yeah.
So the thing I love about basketball is if you have a basketball in your hand, you can always practice, right? It's unlike baseball, right. unlike football, like you need other people.
Right.
But basketball, you don't. But, you know, we had Keith Kloss on the show, you know, good friend of yours. And he was talking about how important the blacktop game is, which I completely agree with him. Mm-hmm. How important was the blacktop game for you in your development?
I mean, it's important to a point. I know, so I really started playing, my mom and dad have been married forever. They're, you know, 50 years oh, wow. you know, together. But my mom had watched the sixth grade tournament, watched me play, yeah, at 12. And so in the seventh grade, she had asked if I wanted to play. So she gave me a nice motherly throw, you know, into playing, and the rest is, you know, history. But in regards to the blacktop, I played really between that seventh grade to actually going into my freshman summer. That was really the only time that I played, you know, blacktop, going to the park and playing. And usually I go to the park when I go to my grandmother's house. I'd stay with her for a week, 2 weeks, and hang out. But she had a couple parks, and she is in Fullerton. But there's a couple parks in the area where guys would hoop. So I'd go down, you know, hoop for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then, you know, jog back to the house because, you know, my grandma's, you know, she's like, look, you got to be home by 6:30 because I'm cooking. You know, dinner's going to be ready, so make sure your tail's home, you know, freshened up, showered, whatever, you know, we can sit down and eat. So at that time, you know, I was playing against older guys. You know, guys were getting off from work. You know, mm-hmm. some of the guys who were going to, you know, Fullerton JC, some of the surrounding Chapman, you know, they used to kind of come down. They lived in the Sunny Hills area. So I would see them and, you know, able to match up and see, you know, what my skills were. So at that time, there was a lot of growth, you know, that was happening. At the same time, you know, my parents would take me, you know, wherever. And, you know, where there was opportunity to play up, you know, they go ahead and, you know, just throw me to the fire, you know? So, like I said, you know, that seventh, eighth, going into ninth grade, that was, you know, huge development for me, being able to play against people, you know, my size, bigger, who were, you know, doing things with the ball, you know, playing inside and out. And that's, you know, really how I honed my game, was playing against those guys and seeing, you know, really how they got down, where it's like, okay, you're 6'4", 6'6", 6'7". You know, guys handle the ball, play inside, play outside, and that was it.
Yeah, and if you get some grown-ass men who just had a bad day at work and they're coming to the park
right.
for a long day. So.
Right, right. But yeah. But truth be told, that's the difference between being able to play at different levels, because you knew if he had, you know, that bad day and he's looking to take out that frustration, that aggression, like almost like in a league of their own, there's no crying on the court.
Right. Right.
You know, so you go ahead and, you know, you'd play. And if you got knocked down, you know, if you didn't get back up, you were done.
And you weren't calling fouls.
So, yeah. So you had, you know, you had to learn, you know, how to play.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of ways people learn how to play too is watching a lot of game film, you know, watching, you know, some of the best players play. And I mean, it's a special time when you're growing up, especially in your area. I mean, you had the Showtime Lakers, you had UCLA. It's a really exciting time in basketball for general. And I'm just curious who some of the guys that you looked at and wanted to play like were. Like, who was that guy that you looked at their game and tried to build your craft?
You know, from the NBA level, and I actually had a chance to meet him, you know, his first couple of years in the league, was Eddie Jones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so EJ, you know, that was my guy. And I was looking at people who had similar body types. Like, I didn't know. I mean, if I would have known what my body was going to turn into, you know, from being, you know, 13, 14, 15 to now being 43 and saying, okay, you know, you're going to be, you know, 218, you know, you're going to have, you know, size, strength, quickness, whatever. You know, then you can go ahead and really specialize. But I was just looking at guys who I had a similar game to. James Worthy, you know, running the wing, finishing strong. Like I said, EJ, you know, Eddie Jones, looking at Pippen, and then even looking at Rodman. You know, so those were guys who I looked at in terms of, you know, just kind of body type, body style. And then as far as like, you know, with say like, you know, who do you want to watch on a regular basis? You know, getting the West Coast games, you're looking at Sean Kemp, you know, with the Supersonics. You know, loved, you know, watching Kemp. You know, of course, watching the Lakers, you know, at that time, Lake Show, you know, it was kind of the dark years. That was Dell Harris, you know, at that time. But you know, they had Nick the Quick. Mm-hmm. You know, they had Nick the Quick. You know, they had Eldon Campbell. You know, they had a couple pieces. And then, you know, at the end of the 90s, you know, Shaq's, you know, coming in. Kobe comes in, you know, that kind of stuff. And things start to make a change. But it was kind of the dark years. You know, at that point when I was playing through high school from, you know, 93 to 97.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, when you talk about your high school career, I want to ask you about this because we've had a lot of guests on the show from your area. I mean, like Shea Cotton, Jelani Garner, Keith Kloss, Ricky Price. I mean, the list goes on. We've had a lot. So it was a really special time. And I mean, you had some accolades. I mean, you were league MVP in both 96, 97, got player of the year, your high school's all-time leading scorer. I mean, that's a big deal. So what can you share about your high school experience and maybe some other familiar names that you went up against? Like, did you maybe have a rival that just kind of irritated you a little bit more than others?
I mean, I don't know if anybody really irritated. I think at that time, everybody was trying to get at Shea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I tell people, Shea was Bron before LeBron. You know, so that was everybody, you know, who they were shooting for. And, you know, I'm cool with Shea, you know his family, everything else. You know, but Shea was the person that people were shooting for. You know, on top of that, I mean, in terms of rivals, it was just different because people competed. You know, so, you know, like what you were saying, you know, Ricky Price, and I watched Ricky play. You know, the homies and the OGs are Jelani Garner and, you know, his son Biggs is, you know, he's doing big things right now. You know, Keith, you know, of course, you know, Corey Benjamin. You know, these are guys who, you know, I knew, you know, I played with, you know, BD, you know, Barron's, you know, one of the homies, you know, and it's just with us, you know, Travis Reed, a handful of others, you know, it was either you got to the show or you went overseas and you played forever, you know, abroad. So, you know, we had really special careers. You know, we understand with the show, it is a business, you know, whether you got in, you didn't, whatever, that didn't mean that you couldn't hoop.
Right.
You know, and being able to come back and play in different summer leagues and that kind of stuff, you know, people, you know, really knew what you were about. But in terms of, you know, really that question, didn't really have any rivals. It was just more so if I had opportunities to play in Los Angeles and to play in Orange Counties, it was to go out there and literally crush anybody who I was playing against to go ahead and prove my worth, because it was always, well, you live out in the IE. You know, the competition isn't that good. It's lesser. So if I went ahead and got my 35 or 40, I knew I was cooking.
Right.
You know, so it wasn't about walking around like a proud peacock. It was just like, look, even though location-wise, this is where I grew up, I'm no chump.
Right. You belong.
So it was more so of just being able to play against whoever and just, you know, earn your keep. And that's really what it was. Not really a rival. It was, you know, these are my peers and this is just what we do. You know, we crush and, you know, we're going to have opportunities to go to school, you know, et cetera.
Yeah. And I love hearing that stuff, especially, you know, during your time in Southern California. I mean, that's one thing to compete at that level, but I love asking about like the ABCD or the Nike or the Pump Brothers camps. Like, I'm assuming that you attended at least one of those. And
all of them.
Nice. Yeah, all of it. But then this is going to be a good conversation. I mean, yeah. I got to know what some of maybe your most memorable moments are from those camps, and what kind of measuring stick was that for you to see where you stood against the best of the best?
I mean, the pumps, I was actually with the pumps around this time last year. You know, they've gotten out of the business in terms of, with high school hoops. But, the pumps West Coast camp, that's where it was at. We had the superstars as well. Etope, he was running that. I think he still is affiliated with it. At the time, Dino Strigonis, Dino's was just starting out. And I still hear from Dino's and Etope and everybody else. It's a huge camaraderie, and family. But with the pumps, one of the things with the pumps is they had their exposure weekend camps, which would be a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So you'd have a camp in September, which would be for the fall signing. You'd have one in May for the late or early signing period, right? Or excuse me, that'd be the late signing period, end of the year. And then they'd have their summer camp. And I just remember everybody used to, show up at the pump stuff. And then for the summer camp, because I know, because I went my junior year, we had won it. We won camp, everything else. And, it was just, great opportunity. Jamal Mosley, that's, one of our guys. He's coaching Orlando right now. But, J-Mo, he was, playing. He was one of the, few guys out of, San Diego County, who had game, who showed up. So it was him, David Abramowitz, who played at the San Diego State, the Walton boys. So, I mean, we had everybody who was there. But, I mean, being at the pumps was always fun because it was – we played at, Cal State Dominguez Hills, and you had five courts that were lined up. So, I mean, there really wasn't a whole bunch of bleacher space to sit down. But, I mean, you could just sit down and just watch people play, and you could size up the competition. Hey, we beat your squad today. Let's see who's going to, win, this evening, whatever. So you really just had that comp that was there. Everybody knew who, received the scholarship from the pumps. We knew what guys paid, their 500, to be there for the week. But at the end of the day, there'd be, 350, 400 kids there, trying to show their stuff, trying to get off and trying to get looks. And some of those kids, they knew what the measuring stick was. Playing against, like Shannon Swillis, trying to think who else. I know, I want to say, I can't remember. I know Jason Hart played in, some of the weekend stuff, that would go on, pre-late signings. That's one of the guys. And, played against Jay Hart, also in college and everything. Known Jay since, junior high.
Yeah, but he was nice.
Yeah, yeah, solid point guard. And, with lockdown defense. And it was one of those things where, everybody used to just show up and just play. And that was the thing. I mean, if I knew you guys were watching and, we might have been roommates, for the overnight camp, for the summer camp, even though we're playing on different teams, I'm going to watch you guys play. So it gave you opportunities to meet people, and the pumps had so many kids coming because I want to say it's from like Louisiana all the way west. So there were people who, you might have heard about or never really crossed paths against, and then you had opportunities to, play against them. Played against Cole at ABCD. Oh, yeah. Wow. That same summer, him, want to say who else was there? I know Tim Thomas was there, Lester Earl, Rock Lloyd. Those were just a few guys, who were there. But, that was, a great opportunity for me to come in. I mean, my team, we got smashed. I mean, we were terrible. But it gave me great opportunity to play against guys who I was hearing about. And, again, being able to match up and see, where your level's at and areas where you need to improve.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, so those were both my junior year. And then my senior year, I went to Nike, Shea was there. Basically just the Cali kids, we were all there. Tayshaun, BD, Travis Reed. I mean, we were all there, cause we played, for Pat Barrett, or we played for Dark Stamps, between the two, we were the two squads, in LA that everybody's trying to get at. Nobody could get at us. I mean, that's just what it was, So whenever we had opportunities to play against one another, we always knew it was going to be a battle and a showdown. One, because everybody played with everybody at some point, you know, at some time. But, you know, it was, you know, again, just good opportunity to go, you know, somewhere, you know, and show your craft.
Where do you think you figured out you could play at the next level? Like, was it the pump? Was it the Nike? Or was it even before that? Like, when did you have that confidence to go, I know I can play the next level. I know I can play college ball.
I mean, being 14 and cooking dudes who played at Cal Baptist. You know? So at 14, it's like, okay, I'm a kid, right? I mean, I didn't have any type of body or anything like that, but I knew I had a skill set and, you know, some guys coming in, open gym. It's like, okay, you know what? I do have a little stank in my game. If I keep working, you know, I'll be able to, I know I can at least play, you know, JUCO or, you know, kind of D3.
Right.
You know, and I knew that that wasn't where I was looking to play at. You know, my goals, my aspirations, because coming into high school, I was already having, you know, letters from D1s already coming in. So I already knew what it was, but I knew at the same time, I'm still a long way from my potential. I was still a newbie in terms of playing.
Right, right.
So I still had a lot of growth, a lot of development that needed to go on. So, you know, there was no ego or anything like that. It was just, I'm hungry. Yeah, and it was more of just a hunger for knowledge, hunger for, you know, just learning new skills. So, yeah, I used to watch, you know, a lot of, you know, watching the Lakers, watching the Clippers, you know, UCLA, watching SC, Long Beach State, and just watching games. You know, even like my older brother, you know, he was playing JUCO at the time, and, you know, he was between Fullerton and Riverside, but watching, you know, guys on those teams and just seeing how they played. You know, and that's where I was just, you know, taking bits and pieces to trying to, you know, throw it into my game.
Sure, sure. You know, I want to talk to you about the recruiting process, because you're obviously a West Coast kid. We've been talking about it and all the great competition you're playing against. You end up in Providence, right? I'm an East Coast guy. I mean, I know when I came out to the West Coast, it was a whole different galaxy. What made you choose to go to Providence? Was there a close number two? And what made you not stay on the West Coast and go to like a UCLA or a USC? Like,
I was all set and ready to go to SC originally.
Okay.
And Charlie Parker ended up losing his job, you know, to Mike Bibby and to Henry Bibby, Mike's dad.
Yeah.
And the whole situation, it was, you know, there's a bunch of gray areas, you know, on things. And so, you know, I just didn't feel comfortable with it, you know, with what had gone down. And then I had actually verbally committed to go to Pepperdine. You know, Coach Romar, and he's, you know, he's back, you know, and I've known Romar since, you know, eighth grade, great guy. You know, I still, you know, hear from Ro. And as you know, anybody who speaks on Romar, it's just positive. I mean, he's just, you know, that guy.
Yeah. We hear that name a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's just been great, even just within the Southern Cal, you know, basketball hoop community, because everybody has some sort of, you know, connection with Romar because he was always around. But you know, I'd actually verbaled to Pepperdine, and they had a situation where some guys got thrown out of school. So, you know, he went ahead and told me what the situation was, let me out of my, my verbal, my commitment. And then at that point, I was just like, well, you know, I know D Flight, because D Flight played against my brother, you know, JUCO, and D Flight was actually, working concession back in 94. That's when I met Keith at LA City. And he was doing that. So, you know, he was just giving me little tidbits while playing in games. So, you know, with that, you know, I knew D Flight, knew Austin. So I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to go out east, you know. And I knew about the Big East, you know, one of my, you know, favorite players when I was in high school, you know, watching like my sophomore year was Kerry Kittles, you know, and Ray Allen. So it's one of those things. And in my sophomore year, I was wearing the one high sock like Kerry Kittles was. And I was just trying to, you know, pogo stick any chance I got. So, you know, so that's really what it was. And I just knew that the Big East always, you know, I'd rush home from school and watch, you know, Big Mondays and just watch the game. So I knew what the Big East was about. And, you know, I just wanted to get the signing process done. So, you know, PC came in. I had Pittsburgh come in a little bit before, you know, and truth be told, I mean, Notre Dame was heavy on me and they just kind of disappeared kind of at the last second. I was like, you know, go to PC.
Nice.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you mentioned Austin, because I was a big Austin Crozier fan, and God Sham God, this is what the jersey is. It's a sham.
Right, yeah, of course.
But I mean, I was big fans of them, and I remember when you came in, and I enjoyed watching you and Jamel Thomas play. And I'm just curious what your biggest adjustment from high school to college was. Like, for me, is the speed and the pace of the game. But I'm curious for you what it was, since you're always kind of the guy on the team. What was it like playing next to such a prolific scorer and just also adjusting to the college game?
I mean, the college game, I think the biggest difference was just the speed and size of guys. You know, you go from high school where you might be physically bigger than people, or you may be faster, just more dominant, to being at the bottom of the totem pole again. So you got to make that, you know, adjustment. And coming in, you know, at PC with five, you know, I knew what five's role was. I knew he was the man on the team, and I knew I had to just get in where I fit in, you know, and being a multidimensional player, you know, I was stuck playing, you know, power forward center, yeah. You know, but it was kind of a trip, because our team, we played, you know, three guys at 6'6", and we had, you know, two smaller guys, you know, running, you know, kind of the one and two, and, you know, we were able to get things done.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, your sophomore year, I got to ask this question, because you had a coaching change and Coach Welsh comes in, and I'm curious if that was a surprise for you. And I mean, that's got to be tough, because I'm sure you're signing for a school thinking that, you know, that's going to be your coach for 4 years. So when that happened, did you consider maybe transferring, or did Coach Welsh earn your trust pretty quick?
I mean, you know, talking to, you know, Coach Gillen, because, you know, he had signed an extension, you know, the season before, you know, when they made the run to the Elite Eight. So he had already signed the extension before I'd even signed, you know, at the school. So I figured he was going to be there. But at the same time, I know it's a business. So it wasn't anything where it was personal or anything like that. It's just, it's business, you know, because, I mean, truthfully, when you're in school, it's a job, you know, and it's a job depending on the situation. You know, you're tight with certain guys, you're not tight with the other guys. And, you know, it's just, it's work. You know, everybody's there for the same purpose, to try to win games, you know, trying to have the same goal, which is to ultimately win the NCAA tournament. But at the same time, to be able to move on in terms of with your hoop career, you know, in school, you know, I really wasn't concerned with the school side of things, because I knew wherever I went to school at, I was going to receive a good education. So that was going to happen. But it was more so what's going to happen in terms of hoops. And truth be told, it didn't matter with what school I had signed at, because at that time, every single school I looked at, the coaches all left at some point within those 4 years. So, you know, again, it's business.
Yeah. And it changes a lot too, right? I mean, it's not like it used to be where you'd have like a guy like John Wooden that coaches there forever. It's there's a lot of turnover. And, you know, one of the things that our younger listeners love to hear about, so we always ask this question, is, what was the NBA draft process like for you personally? Did you have any memorable workouts? Did you expect to be drafted? What type of feedback were you getting, you know, during that time period?
Well, I mean, I wasn't in the draft or the process. You know, I played out of position. I played power forward center at 6'6". And even though I was able to get the job done, there's no way on God's green earth I can go up against Shaq. And I wasn't some, you know, Rodney Rogers at 6'6", weighing 265. You know, so I can actually go ahead and stand them up on the block.
Right.
So I knew that for myself, it was about having to get back to doing things on the wing. And even though I would do that in the summer leagues and say no, you know, with Rod Smith back in L.A., I'd come back to school, get thrown back into the post. So even though I was working on my craft in the summer and proving myself, because I'd be in, you know, the top three in scoring with stuff, I get pigeonholed back into that spot. So that was a disappointing, you know, side of things. Now, grand scheme of things, post up, I know I can get a bucket, you know, anybody, you know, on the block. But in terms of, you know, what was needed in the show, if I was in the situation that was similar to Sean Marion, having more of a Mark Dickel type player, you know, who I know Mark personally, played against Mark, you know, stuff like that in New Zealand, but somebody who was really looking to, you know, just his style of play is just advance the ball, kind of like a Jason Kidd type, then I think that would have potentially put me in a different scenario, but that wasn't the case, you know, as far as with our playing style at school. you know, so you play within the style with, you know, how the offenses operated, ran, and that was it. So I knew it was about going abroad, honing my craft, and seeing what would happen, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm glad that you brought up Mark Dickel, because we've been trying to get him on the show for a long time. I'm a big Dickel fan for sure. I used to love watching those UNLV teams. But before I go any further into overseas, because I do want to ask you about that, I actually want to ask you about the Nike Battlegrounds League, because I know that you're named the Battlegrounds King, and I know a lot of our younger listeners might not be very familiar with it. So if you could tell our listeners exactly what Battlegrounds is and how that competition works. And did you – I mean, you talked about how you can get a bucket any time in the post, so you obviously proved that. But how did you even get your foot in the door in that league? Like, how did you even – like, how did the opportunity even come up?
Well, there's two things with the Battlegrounds, so I want to clarify. So at Venice Beach, you had – the 5-on-5 Battlegrounds. And that was just the pro-am that was going on. Nike sponsored it. Nike sanctioned. You had like Bo Outlaw playing. Penny was out there playing, you know, one summer. Well, he was attempting to play. Nike wasn't going to allow him to play because he was coming off some injuries at the time. But, you know, it was almost, in some ways, it was almost like the Drew League in a sense, because you had guys playing in the Drew. Yeah, guys playing in the real run. Shout out to DeAnthony Langston. You know, you also had the Summer Pro League at Long Beach State. You know, so you had a handful of pro-ams that were going on during the summer. So anyways, that particular summer, I didn't, for whatever reason, I don't know what had gone on, but I didn't play in the 5-on-5, but I had received a phone call about the one-on-one situation. So received the phone call. They're just like, look, I think you got a good shot, you know, at winning. Why don't you go ahead and get into it? Like, hey, you know, let's roll. And so playing with the Battlegrounds, it was a 10-second shot clock.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it wasn't a full half court. It, you know, there were no threes from the sides of the court. So basically you played probably the top third of the arc is what the width of the court was. Played inside a cage, and it was really just north and south. You know, so you had to have a bit of everything to be able to win. You had to be able to shoot the three ball, had some mid-range, drive, and post up. And that was really the combination of being able to have success with it, being able to do a bit of everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. And I know there's like a DVD with it. I know I've seen it before. I didn't remember seeing you seeing it. Were you in the DVD?
I'm actually on the cover.
On the cover?
Okay. I'm on the cover.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, it's been so long. It's been right? so long. I mean, it's been like a good 20 years, you know.
Yeah, so, well, it's more than 20.
Yeah. So I mean, keep in mind, I was like 10 when I saw this. So my apologies for not knowing that. But
right. No, that's amazing.
I mean, it should be obvious that the Battlegrounds King is on the cover, but I gotta ask. No,
even taking a step back. So the Battlegrounds actually started in 2002. So I don't know if you know Mike Campbell, you know, from New York, but Mike had won the New York tournament and I had won the LA tournament. And that was just what it was in 2002. Now, 2003, they decided to add some more cities, and that's what was aired on TV. Okay. So MTV had gone ahead, they recorded it. It was supposed to be, you know, a super huge, you know, show, because at the time, the N1 mixtape tour just got started. So that was airing every week on ESPN. You had the Magic Johnson competition that was going on. That was on MTV. And then we ended up having the Battlegrounds. Now, Young Kim, you know, who I was kicking it with in Hong Kong, that's the big bro. Jimmy, trying to think who else. There's a couple others, and I'm drawing a blank on their names, but they had gone ahead and they put together the Battlegrounds. So that first year, it was a lot of steals that were taken, and they had some video that was thrown together. And then that next year, they decided, since they added the cities, they're just going to do it as, you know, a reality show. And now with a lot of the reality shows, as I've done, you know, some acting on reality shows, all that stuff is scripted.
Yeah.
You know, with certain things, they'll go ahead and say topic, play it at Providence, West Coast. And that's our bond. So the conversation could be real, but they're giving us topics.
Right.
But at that time, reality TV was brand new, you know, with stuff. There's only a few things that had gone on. So at that time, they just went ahead, took the video camera, and they let it run. And whatever happened would happen. And I didn't realize this. I found this out 17 years later, but the Battlegrounds was put together for only 100,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's hanging out with the homie Young. So he's telling me what had gone on and how it was pieced together and all that type of stuff. So, you know, we kind of had this cult following, you know, with the Battlegrounds that was literally just put together for, you know, literally no money. It's just, you know, love of the game, love of the storylines, people, you know, that was it. But I mean, it was really amazing to find that out, you know, so many years later.
Yeah, that is amazing. I had no idea about any of that stuff. I mean, that's really cool stuff. And, you know, with the Battlegrounds, who would you say was your toughest opponent, and how many opponents were you really going through during that whole process? And this might be a dumb question, but I feel like one-on-one isn't really practiced a whole lot. So do you think maybe winning that competition helped you find yourself even more as a player? Like, did you learn more about yourself as a player after that experience?
I mean, playing ones is essential. Yeah. I mean, you can drill all you want, but when you actually have that opportunity to play ones with somebody, you know, you get to actually put what you're working on in game situations. You know, so let's just say, you know, for the last week, I've been working on my jumper, you know, it might be a pull-up jumper, but when I play ones, I get to actually practice that. I got somebody defending me, bumping me, all that kind of stuff. So if every time I'm raising up, the ball's getting slapped out of my hands, then I'm realizing, okay, there's something I need to do to change that so that I can be more effective. You know, so I know for like myself and many of my friends, ones is a way of life, not just from the conditioning side of things and also the practice, but it allows things to be real time. So the Battlegrounds, you know, going through people, I know the first year out in LA, I had to win 5 games in order to, you know, be crowned, you know, the winner. And with that, everybody played, you know, professionally. You know, at some place, somewhere, some point in time. So it wasn't like there was some scrubs or anything like that. Like, everybody had a legitimate background. So it was just, you know, however you got matched up. I don't know how they matched people up. I don't know if they were looking at size, age, experience, whatever, but that's just what it was. So playing out in LA and winning the LA, you know, side of things. I mean, you had some legends out there, you know, who were playing, you know, older guys. You know, we had, I'm trying to think of a couple of the older guys at the time. I know Idris, he had played with, what's his face? He played for the Spurs, Bruce Bowen. They played together at Cal State Fullerton. I'm trying to think who else. There was big Bruce Wheatley. He had played, you know, he had been in the show for a little bit. He was a, you know, LA guy. You know, a handful of other guys, you know, Matt Garrison had played, you know, who, you know, he was kind of a LA transplant, but there's a lot of guys who got into it. So, you know, you just never really knew who you're going to match up against. But that first year was hard because you just had no idea. Yeah. The next year, you knew who the competition was because everybody won their city. You know, so playing against, you know, baby Shaq, Hugh Jones, you know, he was a battle. Playing against, you know, Paul McPherson, you know, he was a battle. Playing against Junie Sanders, he was a battle. You know, so everybody was tough playing against because they just had different things, you know, that they did. You know, you had Hugh, who was, you know, just the tank and going through people. You have Paul, who was just athletically gifted, you know, and, you know, very crafty with things. And then you had Junie, who was just a savage, you know, with the ball. So you just, you know, you had to just figure out, and you had to figure things out quickly on yeah. how you're going to play, what your matchup was. Are they lefty? Are they righty? You know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember Paul McPherson too. That guy could play. I remember him in college, and he was one of those guys I really watched a lot of. He's a lot of fun to watch, and I appreciate you sharing that stuff about the Battlegrounds, because I feel like we don't really get to hear about any of this one-on-one stuff too often on this podcast, so that's really awesome. Mm-hmm. But I did want to ask about the overseas, because you had a lot of success playing over there. I mean, 2-time NBL champ. I mean, we went over the accolades at the beginning, but a lot of guys hop around team to team overseas compared to like the NBA, where they stick around right. on teams. I'm curious, like, what a culture shock that was initially, but also how difficult is it to kind of find your role overseas when you're constantly like hopping countries? Like, I mean, that's got to be kind of difficult. And I don't think the average fan might think about that. So could you maybe talk a little bit about finding your role on, seems like a new team or a new country every year or two?
Yeah, I mean, that's usually what would kind of happen. I mean, you know, some guys are fortunate to be able to kind of stay in one country their whole career. But for the most part, you know, guys bounce around. And depending on your leagues, depending on the situation, you know, your role is always going to change. They might need you to get 30 every night, you know, and that's just, you know, what it is. Other places, it may just be, you know, you score eight, you know, you score eight, you know, grab four rebounds. That's a great game, you know, and everybody only plays maybe, you know, 17, 18 minutes, you know, so you never know what the style of play is going to be. You have, and now it's easier to do research with social media, things being on YouTube, you know, all that kind of stuff. So you can really research leagues. But, you know, and YouTube kind of really came around kind of 2007, 2008, you know, right around there. So prior to, it was just more so word of mouth. You know, did you know somebody who might know somebody who played, you know, in the league? You know, can I, you know, get it, you know, can I get somebody's email address? Or, you know, you might cross paths in the gym. Hey, have you ever played in this country? Oh, yeah, I played. So that was your way of being able to figure out more about the teams. But I always looked at it in the staple of show up in shape, you know, and be coachable, because you don't know what your role is going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's literally what it is. And with your agent, you never know what your agent's going to do, because they might be selling you as a point guard and they need somebody who's 7 feet. So you're already set up for failure. You know, right. So you don't know what's actually going to go on. And that's where it's hard with a lot of agents at the same time. And I can only speak from my own experience, but you don't know how they're selling and marketing.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a Swiss Army knife, you know, and you can play many different ways, how are they selling you? Are they selling you as a Swiss Army knife, or are they selling you because you played the post over here, but there you're playing, you know, shooting guard, you know, right. So you don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, the overseas game is so fascinating to me, and I love like learning more about it. I mean, we had a guy named Sean J. McCaw on the show, and he wrote a book about how to have success overseas, and it's just really interesting stuff. And we love hearing those stories. But one of the favorite things I like to ask about overseas is there's just a lot of wild shit that happens overseas, mm-hmm. like whether it's like in the game or just living in another country. I mean,
yeah,
I think you know where I'm going with this, but I want to know like what the craziest experience that you had playing overseas, whether it's in the game or just living in another country. What's that one memory?
I mean, you have more than one.
You can share more than one if you
like. Oh, yeah, we've heard so many magical ones.
I mean, I've been in. One of the scariest was I was playing in Uruguay, and you know, we had finished the game, and we'd always go into the locker room, and they'd always just have a pile where, you know, you'd put your uniforms, so they'd go ahead and, you know, wash everything. So literally walking in, and they're yelling at us like, "Yo, you gotta leave, you gotta leave." And they're just, "All right, well, let me go get a shirt." "No, like, you gotta leave now." So like literally, you know, had just taken off our jersey, still got our hoop shorts on, whatever, still got, you know, our shoes on. And we're being pushed out of the locker room trying to figure out what's going on. Next thing you hear, pop, 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 pop. Somebody's letting a gun off in the gym. And it's a one way in, one way out. And the season before, there was a situation where same thing happened, different gym. And there was a mother and child who were killed by a stray bullet.
Whoa.
Yeah, so when that had happened, it was literally whoever was down with the team, whether it was, you know, people's kids, you know, homies, you know, girlfriends, wives, whatever it was, you just grabbed onto whoever and you were running out as quick as possible. But it was literally a one way in, one way out. So trying to get out without getting trampled.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was, you know, really just like one of like the scariest situations, you know, to be in. Craziest, I was playing in Hungary, and we had to win 12 out of 13 games to get into the playoffs. And it literally came down to last second shot. Our point guard came down and he threw up a prayer over this dude, Polish dude, who was like 7'4", like no joke. Oh, wow. And our guy, he played, Kestis Marshalonis, he played for Lithuania, played on their national team. 2000, in the Olympics, they took third. But Kestis came down, threw up this left hand hook. It literally rolled on like the front of the backboard, bounced around. I don't know how people missed it because they were trying to tip it off the rim. It stayed in. So we're hyped, but at the same time, we're running off the court because we just see the fans rushing the court from the other team. And as we look over our shoulder, we see this dude hop out of the stands and he's angry. No, he's cussing the referee out saying, you know, Lord knows what, it's in Hungarian. But dude runs full speed and you see him just jump in the air, both feet up, and just drop kicks the referee. Back in his chest. You see his chest just explode open like this and he's falling back on the ground. And next thing you know, the guys on top of him just beating the living daylights out of him because they had paid the refs.
Oh,
so they paid the refs to win the game.
Oh,
yeah. But the situation was is that last like 30 seconds of the game, it was impossible for the referees to call a foul or anything like that because the game was just moving too quickly. Yeah. So they were trying to find something, but it'd be, you know, either a missed shot on one end, you know, with a long rebound that would start to, you know, break the other way. So it was just going. So it's just mayhem for that last second shot. And there were some, they had thrown the ball out of bounds. So we literally had 4 seconds. We're down one. And that's how, you know, things ended. But, you know, it's super crazy with that.
Wow. That's a great story. I mean, that definitely jumps into our top 10 for sure. We've never heard about the ref being paid off and then getting drop kicked like Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
So that's definitely, I mean, we've heard, you know, getting pulled off buses with machine guns. We've heard. Mm-hmm. We've heard girls being completely naked, like behind the basket when people are taking foul shots. We've heard people lighting coins up, heating them in chrome.
Lighting coins. That's...
Everybody's smoking cigarettes in the stadium. Yeah. I mean, it just seems like absolute chaos. But to bring it back to basketball, who is the one guy overseas? Doesn't have to be a guy that we know, right? Because obviously it's beautiful. We got Google and people can, you know, can figure out who these people are. Who was the one guy that was the guy overseas, in your opinion, when you play there?
I'd say probably, well, the homie Mike Batiste. He was one of the guys. Heard from Mike a couple weeks ago, about a month ago, month and a half ago. Actually, a little bit longer than that. But, you know, Mike, you know, he held it down for a minute, you know, playing with Panathinaikos. Also playing with Basikas in Turkey. You know, Mike was a EuroLeague MVP. You know, so he held it down. Trajan Langdon. You know, he ran the show for a minute, you know, playing in Russia. And I think he won a couple EuroLeague titles. Those are guys who kind of come to mind. But, you know, the truth is it's really hard to say who was running the show because – depending on where you played, you may have crossed paths. You might not have crossed paths, you know. Yeah. You know, depending on, again, agency situation, you might have been on a team that might have played EuroLeague or may not. You know, Latin America was trying to do a EuroLeague that was the League of Americas. You know, so they had the League of Americas. They had the South American Cup, you know, stuff like that. So those were some international tournaments that, you know, people played in. You know, but, you know, it's really hard to say, like, who was just running the show. You just knew with certain places, you know, guys got calls. They got respect calls because they had been there for, you know, X amount of years.
Sure.
You know, but I just know those two guys, you know, come to mind because I know that they had won, you know, a lot of titles.
Yeah. And, you know, since we're talking overseas basketball really quick, I was very curious if you could tell our listeners about Wild Ball. I mean, what exactly is Wild Ball and how did you get introduced to it? We got to hear that. Got to hear how you got introduced to that. Because I think it's Keith Klossett or maybe Jermaine Barnes that was telling us about this.
No, so Keith actually told me about it. Okay. So I was actually looking to go back to South America to play. And agent I was working with, he was just kind of MIA, you know, with stuff. So anyways, I was talking to Keith and he was telling me, he was like, yeah, come over to China. You know, they have this thing called Wild Ball. I'm like, what's Wild Ball? Never heard of it. And he was just like, you know, they play and they pay a good amount of money. I'm like, okay, I don't know how you can be any more vague, but all right, whatever. So, you know, he's telling me about WeChat. I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, what in the world is WeChat? And he's like, it's the Chinese Facebook, Twitter, you know, whatever, you know, Instagram. So I put that on my phone. Keith is in, he's going to China, or he's going back to China at this point. This is October. Yeah, this is like October 2016. So he's telling me this. I'm like, all right, okay. You know, we'll just see what it is. So I'm trying to get in contact with some people. He gave me some names. Everybody's just being super vague. I'm like, you know, this blows, whatever. And my friend Marcus Elliott, he was actually playing for Eastern in Hong Kong. And I was talking to Marcus. I was just like, you know, how'd you end up over there? And, you know, he was just telling me what had gone down to the coach, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he was just like, you know, I passed your information over to, you know, kind of the Chinese contact. And so he said he's going to message you back. So the Chinese contact is working with the team. He actually is affiliated with this wild ball stuff. So he's like, hey, you want to come over, whatever, you'd be able to make, like, whatever, dude. So I go ahead. I, you know, get all my paperwork done, leave on Christmas 2016, land over in China. And 2 days later, I got a game. I'm like, all right, whatever. I'm playing outside. I retired from playing outside in 2005. You know, I stopped playing outside. Like, I don't play blacktop, nothing like that. This stuff's terrible on my body.
Yeah.
Playing outside, I'm just like, man, this is some bullshit. So I'm just like, all right, let's go. So I go, and on top of that, I have no other foreigners. I got a bunch of Chinese dudes, you know, dudes sitting there on the sidelines smoking butts quicker than they can light them up. It's like, this is some crazy scene out of like Bloodsport, right? So literally, I have an outdoor court, everybody's smoking. I'm sitting there like, okay, what is going on here, right? So
you're thinking you're getting punked, right? Like you're an Ashton Kutcher punked or something.
Literally, I'm just like, what is it? So the other team's loaded. They got four African dudes, you know, who were able to play as locals. And then they had a couple of, you know, American guys on the team. I'm just like, man, we probably going to get smashed. So go ahead. We play. The one Chinese dude, little micro mini dude, find out he's a 10th degree black belt.
Oh, wow.
Dude is all left. Like, can't go right to save his life, and dude's getting a hella buckets with me. So between the two of us, we scored 90. We ended up losing by 4. Nobody else on our team scored. You know, so went ahead. I think I ended up having like 45, you know, in the game. And I think he ended up having like 30. The rest of our team had just a couple of points. And afterwards, they give me $800 cash. All right, cool. Whatever. Let's keep moving. Let's see what's next. Next day I play, I get a grand. I'm like, just to play basically some men's league bullshit ass basketball? Like, well, let's see smokers. What happens. Because the thing is, they're paying more than a lot of places at this point in time.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so just for the week, because I mean, unless you're, you know, playing on kind of an elite EuroLeague team where they may be late on payments, I'm sitting here getting cash either before the game or right after the game. And literally, it's just a workout. So I'm like, all right, well, let's just see what happens. So that's how I got into wild ball. But the whole thing about it is that it turned into people realize that you can really play.
Yeah.
And so the deals would go down between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m. So okay. You just get this random person messaging you on your WeChat and be, Zach, Eric, are you available Saturday through Sunday? Okay, yeah, I got some games. Okay, you know, I got 6 games. You want to play? Well, what's the money? Well, I can pay you 500. I don't play for 500.
It's like drug dealing.
Well, I got to talk to the boss. All right, yeah, whatever. So everybody's trying to get their cut, right?
Oh, wow.
So you sit there and you go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it's like, look, this is the price. You're going to pay me a G per game, plus when we get to the semis, I need double that. And then when we win the whole thing, I need triple that. Because if not, I'm not playing, period. Well, I don't know. They don't have the money. All right, fine. Leave me alone.
Wow.
Next thing you know, 10 minutes later, well, you know, the boss said that he can do that. Look. I know you're just trying to get your cut, so this is what we're going to do. I need X amount for pool play. I need this for quarterfinals. I need this for semifinals, this for winning the whole thing. Because you already know my squad's going to win the whole thing. Yeah. So, you want to get paid or do you want to lose? Because I know somebody will pay me. So, you just tell me. And that's literally how the negotiations would go.
Wow.
And so, when they finally decide, me being me, look, I don't know you. I need some money sent to my phone. So, I need at least $2,500. Okay. So they go ahead. I have $2,500, you know, 2 minutes later. And then they give you a random plane ticket. So you go to the airport, you get this random plane ticket. You go to, you have no idea where you're going to. You're not on the travel. You're not on the tourist guide. You're somewhere out in the sticks where if anything happened, nobody would ever find you. Trust me.
That's
like certain things, even when you're using your VPN and trying to use Google to find stuff, it's still not coming up as an existing place.
Wow.
Yeah. So you're really out in the middle of nowhere where people have never seen a Westerner.
Wow.
So with us coming in, the wives' tales are, I'm dirty. So you'd have people literally trying to rub my skin.
Wow.
Because they want to know if the wives' tale is true or not. So you have opportunities to actually go ahead and break a lot of stereotypes.
Right, right.
You know, it'd be the situation, well, why is there a black guy and a white guy together? Aren't they supposed to be enemies? Because in the movies, this is...
Oh, wow.
So everything you would hear would be movie this, or this is what, you know, people have said. So you're able to break so many different stereotypes and barriers because nobody has come in contact with, you know, some foreigners.
Wow.
So you'd have many experiences like that. You know, so you go ahead, you get off the plane. You might have to get off the plane. They have a cab that takes you to the train station. Then you might ride on the train for another 3 hours, 4 hours. So sometimes if they say 2 hours, in my book, it means five. Because it would be a five-hour trip.
Yeah.
So you're in the middle of nowhere in some janky, depending on what it is, you're in a janky hotel where you might have a squatty potty, which is literally just something where you got to squat over. You know, or you might be in a ritzy... your hotel that would be the equivalent of like a Renaissance Marriott, which they have the Wanda, you know, over there. So you might be staying in the Wanda. So it's like, okay, you know what? At least I'm going to have good breakfast. You know, it's depending on where you're at, it's going to be more Western food for breakfast, whatever, or it might be a little more, you know, Chinese, depending on location. But you go out there and you just play. Referees might be cheating because they've been paid. They're getting paid during the game, whatever. So you might be literally having to whoop ass, you know, literally arch rivals like the old game video game.
Yeah,
while you're playing.
Yeah, and they might be getting drop kicked again. You know,
so. Oh, I'm not. When I say whooping ass, I'm talking about there's times you go into the hoop, boom, and you lay somebody.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's some Wild West stuff right there.
Literally. So, wow. You know, so it was really just. It was really just some really crazy stuff. And at the same time, it was also very beautiful too, because you have people who just love basketball.
Yeah.
That's just what it was. It didn't matter the level. Like my mom, you know, my mom and dad, and my parents are older. My parents are, you know, 74, but they could go out there and they could have played for me because literally the pace of the game was just, they just wanted to be someplace. They just wanted to be seen with some Westerners. Yeah. Take pictures. Shoot a three. Make a dunk. Hey, everybody's happy. And that's that's what it was. But then there were some other places where you had some dudes who played CBA, some Chinese guys who played CBA, and you had dudes who could really, you know, rock on the court.
Right.
So, you know, you're really going at it. You know, so, you know, you actually got to play. And those were the games that you enjoyed because you can actually just play.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where even if the referees were trying to do some cheating stuff, the local Chinese guys would go ahead and they would get on the referees like, no, we're playing for real. Stop the nonsense and just call the game the way it should be played. So you really had people who just love the pure essence and the purity of what basketball is. And then afterwards, whether you won or lost, it was just the camaraderie of, you know, we got to compete. You know, we got to go ahead, you know, we're competing hard, we're bumping, we're grinding out there, doing all that kind of stuff. But you had that respect because depending on the situation, they might need somebody next week.
Yeah.
You were cool with them in the game. You know, you just, you played hard. You competed. So then it'd be like, hey, you know what? Are you free? Let me get your WeChat, get your information. Yo, rock with us for the next 2 weeks. All right, cool. Like, you know what to pay. Don't worry about the money. We got you.
Yeah.
And that's really how things would go on. So it was a way to play and be seen. And through Wild Ball, I was able to get to the ABL, which is the CN Basketball League. And I was able to get into that because, you know, people would play in both. You'd have local guys who played who they'd pass the word like, look, this is somebody who, you know, really legitimately play. And it wasn't somebody who just had the stereotypical look of, okay, he's a black guy, he has some tattoos, you know, and he's from the States, so he must be able to play, because that's how a lot of guys got jobs.
Yeah.
Because they just looked the part.
Right. I mean, what a special thing, though. I mean, it is special when you can find that joy of the game and everybody's enjoying it, but also to help break the stereotypes. I think that's a really cool thing. I mean, what a great experience. That doesn't surprise me at all that Keith would find his way in that. So that just sounds like a Keith thing.
But, that totally sounds like a Keith thing.
But speaking
know, of – No, I mean, Keith is just – you know, he's just – people just gravitate to Keith.
Yeah.
That's just what it is. Everybody just gravitates, and because of his personality of just being, you know, just larger than life.
Yeah.
He's a likable dude.
Yeah. He's a real one. I mean, he's one of the most enjoyable people I've ever met. We really loved Keith a lot. And yep. I mean, speaking of Keith, I think it's really amazing that you're both playing high competitive basketball. I mean, at age 43, I mean, you and Kloss both, I mean, you're both members of the Redeem team, formerly known as Utah Valor of TBT. Mm-hmm. You've had a lot of your former teammates on. And, I mean, you guys play for some great causes, but one of the causes that you play for is Crohn's disease. And I have a family member with Crohn's disease. I mean, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what Crohn's is and how did you find out that you had it? Like, what was your first reaction? Maybe how have you managed Crohn's throughout your playing career also?
Well, for starters, Crohn's is an autoimmune disease, where the disease attacks your body internally, and it can be anywhere from literally the back of your throat to the bottom of your anus. As far as with that, could be your affected areas. And basically it's your digestive tract is, you know, truly what, you know, what it comes down to. In regards to, you know, myself, I didn't know that I had it until 2009, but I went 5 years undiagnosed. So I was playing in Argentina. The team, we were food poisoned, you know, after playing a game and being food poisoned, that's actually what triggered my Crohn's at that point. For younger children, you know, you may have infants who are diagnosed, and the reason why they're diagnosed is a lot of times they go from being on breast milk to, you know, formula, powdered milk, you know, whatever, you know, they may be taking. So that change can be the trigger. So it's something that is genetic. And, you know, there's just different things that, you know, trigger for different people. Some, it'll just lie dormant and it never, you know, reacts. Others, you know, you end up, you know, having issues. So for me, from 2009 up until 2013, I didn't know that I was actually that I had Crohn's, but I had had three surgeries. I had one in Argentina, I had two in Uruguay, and I was just being told that it was an intestinal infection. And that's a very common misdiagnosis. And it's common from a lot of people who I know personally who have Crohn's, they've been told the same thing. And, you know, actually finding a colorectal just by chance, looking at the scarring and everything else where I've had my surgery, she's like, you know, I think you have Crohn's, let's test for it. So at that point, this is early 2014, you know, I was tested, came back positive, and then that actually started my journey in terms of with advocating and figuring out what exactly Crohn's is, what my type of Crohn's is, and the things that I need to do to try to, you know, manage and, you know, live with it as best as possible.
Thank you for sharing about that. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No. I want to learn more about it for sure. I'm sorry. I thought you were done talking. So go ahead.
No. So, I mean, depending on, you know, different people, you know, some people don't need any type of medication. You know, it's just kind of a one-off deal. Others, you know, like myself, you know, I watch my diet. I'm on medication. You know, I've had surgeries. I haven't had to have any type of, you know, intestines or anything like that removed. But as far as with the surgeries that I've had, I mean, they've been, you know, definitely invasive. And, you know, there's definitely a recovery period that goes on with it. So it's definitely nothing that I enjoy having done, but I've had, you know, seven surgeries.
Wow.
You know, surgeries. And, you know, it's just, you just try to roll with the punches. And, you know, the biggest issues is, you know, just having to go through just the insurance, you know, difficulties, you know, being able to get on medication, having to have things approved. You know, when a medication stops being effective for you and having to change to another, in my circumstance, you know, it actually took a few years, you know, to be able to do. So it's no pun intended. It's a pain in the butt, you know, in many ways. But everybody has to figure out what works for them. And then on top of that, for me, I don't let it define me. Because I know that there's many other things that I do, you know, I'm an uncle, I'm a son, you know, I'm a brother, you know, I'm a friend, you know, I hoop, you know, I do, you know, gardening at my house, you know, there's all types of other things that I do, you know, but Crohn's is just a piece of me, but it doesn't, you know, make me who I am, you know, and that's what I always try to advocate and tell people, you know, everybody has issues, everybody has problems, you know, but you just learn how to live with it and manage and just, you know, keep things moving.
Yeah, I appreciate you talking about that because it's something that, I mean, I learned about that years ago. I'm a musician, mm-hmm. and I learned about that from one of the guitar players from Pearl Jam had it.
Okay, yeah.
Very
yeah.
early on, Mike McCready, and I was like, man, right. what is this? You know, and you know, he would talk about the difficulties trying to get through a 2-3 hour show mm-hmm. with it. And that was a long time ago. Like, I think he was diagnosed right. in like 94 or something like right. that. So that's, you know, I mean, obviously technology and the medical field and, you know, everything is, you know, every year that goes by, they find something new. They find a new drug. They find a new
right.
you know, whatnot. So that's when I first learned about it. But you definitely enlightened me more about it, you know, and I really appreciate you doing that. Let's talk a little bit about TBT real quick. Mm-hmm. So you guys were robbed last year of a spot, I think, you know, in the TBT. Mm-hmm. What do you want the committee and the listeners to know about this year's team and why you're deserving of a spot?
I mean, I want the committee to know that, number one, we're playing for – some real causes for starters. You know, we, you know, with the, our former name, you know, we're looking at, you know, veterans, mm-hmm. you know, at the same time, you know, we're also looking at, you know, diabetes. We're also looking at Crohn's disease, you know, so we're supporting causes of people that it's very common, you know, silent diseases in many ways is, you know, how I really like to categorize it because people say, oh, you have Crohn's, well, you don't look sick. And as I, or people say, you don't look old, you know, you're 43. Well, as I tell people, what exactly does sick look like?
Yeah.
And what exactly is old? Right. So with that, you know, we're putting the silent diseases on a main stage and, you know, bringing light to what, you know, people actually live with. So that's the thing that I want them to be able to see. And then at the same time, you know what, we're able to compete at a high level. You know, so just because, you know, we might have illnesses that we live with, we know people who live with these things that may not be directly involved personally, but, you know, it might be a sibling, might be a friend, you know, whoever, you know, might be somebody who, you know, we look up to or, you know, we enjoy their music, whatever it may be, we're representing those people. You know, and at the same time, we actually have a pedigree as well. I mean, I'm a 20 plus year professional player. You know, we have others who have played, you know, professionally. We have others who are representing and carrying that torch for those who might have been, you know, lost soldiers, you know, out there because they ended up losing the battle against diabetes, or they might have lost the battle against Crohn's disease or something like that. So, you know, we get to carry that torch and represent for them. And with the TBT, looking at different teams that are playing for different reasons and different causes, we should be in the mix. And on top of that, we're going to bring the pain. So, you know, if you want to watch good basketball, you're going to put us in and watch us compete.
Yes, I agree. And you know what? As being a diabetic myself, I understand you completely. And a lot of people don't get it. You know, they, mm-hmm. you know, they think, oh, you're good. Everything's cool and whatnot. And it's, well, it's not really. But it's like at the same time, it doesn't define me either. I bike 15, 20 miles a day sometimes. Like right. You know, but it's funny because they say, well, you don't, you look great. Everything looks great. I'm like, well, no, I'm going to live with it the rest of my life.
Right.
But like what you said, it's not going to define me. Like once I realized I had it and it was like, all right, I got to change some things. Then it's just like I just pushed through and I was like, all right, I'm going to still play basketball. I'm still going to bike. I'm still going to run. I'm going to still do the things I love to do. You know, I just have to be careful, check my blood sugar. I have to be careful.
And as you know, when you're feeling, you know, lethargic, you know when things are off.
Yep.
You know, in my case, I know when I'm having a flare. You know, so it might be a few days where I'm just, you know, my energy level's down.
Yep.
You know, I need to go ahead and just rest and take it easy. You know, did I eat something that set me off, or, you know, not on the, you know, the regular diet, so I didn't, you know, eat all the normal things I need to eat. But, you know, people who, and I always say this, and I know that you can relate. I know of many things it's different for us men to have these silent diseases versus women. You know, we know that with a lot of women, you know, there's more, I like to think as far as with resources, support groups, because women speak more than men in terms of speaking about feelings, things that are going on. In terms of with us, especially with our ages, it's you don't share about your feelings. You suck it up. You know, don't be a pussy. Right.
Right.
It's those types of talk that are shed upon us. So when things are actually going on, we know that it has to be a safe place to go ahead and open up and be vulnerable and speak about those things that are, you know, life changing. So if it happens to be, we're speaking to our family about how we're feeling, we have to know that it's a safe place. Like, look, this is what's going on. Or, you know what? I need you for support, or I need you for physical help because I just don't have it right now.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you're coming off a hospital stint and it's just like, you know, I'm going to be kind of out of commission for a while as I recover, you know, from whether it's the surgery or just, you know, being pumped up on a bunch of meds to get me back on track.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't recognize that. And again, as somebody who has a silent disease, that's one of the main reasons why I advocate. And again, another reason why the TBT should go ahead and put us in is because it's about giving us who have these diseases, these silent diseases, a voice.
Yes. I absolutely agree with you, man. And it's one of those things where it's like, I know how I was raised. I'm about the same age as you. I'm 47. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't play that shit anymore. Like I know if I say something and talk, I know that it's helping people that are silent, that going, hey, that guy's going through I think the same thing I'm going through, or that guy's speaking up. It's okay for me to speak up. And you're right, because of the way our generation was raised, we were told not to talk, rub a little dirt on it, all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like panic attacks, things like that, things I would have, I'm thinking like, I'm like, oh my God, like, what am I going through? And not realizing like, dude, there's so many other people going through this. Like you just don't know it because we were told to just shut up.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's, you know, when it comes to that, I don't, you know, when it's like my son's autistic, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like you want to talk about autism, get a hold of me. Like I will do that for you, because when that happened to me 12 years ago, with my kid, I had no idea what world I just was about to walk into.
Right.
And it's important for me to be able to go, hey, you know, I'll talk to you. Just do me a favor, pay it forward, and talk to somebody else. And I think the more we do that, the more we break that kind of that cycle, and then it becomes more of a, you know, just understanding, right? You have more empathy for people because you don't know what they're going through. And with the silent diseases, you have no idea. You see somebody walking down the street and you just say, oh, that's a healthy looking person, and you have no idea what they're battling, right? But then
I mean
that's how I look at that stuff. So I more power to you, man, for having that attitude. I think it's absolutely amazing. Let's talk about give me one story real quick, or one funny thing about either Chris, Marshall, or Kloss. Give me one story. Just something good. I mean, we could do a whole pod on Kloss probably.
Yeah, we could do a whole pod. I think one of the funniest things with Keith, I know that we were involved with. So, and it's actually me. So it was Jermaine Barnes, Keith, and I. We were in the Dominican Republic playing in the Mitchell Cup. This is 2016. Yeah, 2016, January. And there was a guy who, Barnes, as you know, Barnes, he's always giving somebody a nickname. So Barnes ended up dubbing this kid who came on the trip Batman, called him Bruce Wayne. And he was this French-Canadian kid. And he somehow ended up hooking up with some locals and he spent all his money for the weekend and that first night. So we're staying at a hotel, and it has the typical casino, and you know, they have, as a lot of people know with being abroad, certain hotels, they have the casino, they have prostitutes in there, you know, and then they have, you know, regular just bar. So if that's the avenue that you want to go down, you know, it's right there for you. And Barnes does a lot of this stuff because he wants to see if people are serious and want to be professionals, or they're worried about the life off the court, which a lot of people are worried about it. So anyways, Keith is talking, and you know, Keith, hey there, young fella, you need to make sure you buck up, you know, watch yourself. And he got a cigarette and some coffee in his hand, right? Because that's boss, right? Buy him a carton and give him some coffee. He's going to be your best friend. And so he's talking to the young guy, and the young kid's not listening. So this kid goes ahead, that Bruce Wayne, Batman, and he goes ahead and he's just like, you know, this dude, Jermaine Barnes, needs to pay for my breakfast, and he should be paying for my lunch, let alone JB's standing right there. Standing right there. So JB's like, I've just had it. He just walks off, doesn't even say anything. And I'm usually just cool and everything else, but I was just done with this dude just being disrespectful. And Keith is telling people, like, look, these are the things that I've done. You know, this is where, and Keith, you know, Keith will go ahead and tell you, I was the biggest asshole, right? So Keith is telling his tale, right? Know the tale. And the kid's still being disrespectful. I don't care what you did. You weren't that great, blah, 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 blah. So Keith is just like, you know what? The hell with this. So I'm just done watching this. Just this little 23-year-old, never been anywhere, stuff like that, just being disrespectful. I just like, that's it. I'm like, who are you? Like, you can't play. You sit here and you're skipping around in dress shoes and shorts. What's your problem? I'm like, you know what? And like, the guy was just so disrespectful, and not just to boss and the JB, but just to everybody around. He was just on this I'm entitled type deal. And I was just like, I don't know who you are. I don't know who your mama is, but obviously she gave you the money. You've gone ahead, you wasted all your money. You got drug dealers after you who want to kill you. JB's gone ahead and he has locals sitting here trying to take care of you. And you're sitting there cussing out JB, and the man was standing right next to you.
Wow.
And the kid, you just see him, he's just going more and more pale. I'm like, I'm not a violent person, but I should beat the hell out of you right now for being disrespectful. And then after I'm done, get the other 40 guys to go ahead and take their turn, because you're disrespecting everybody right now.
Wow.
The guy at that point, he didn't know what to say. He didn't know what to do. He still didn't want to apologize. I'm like, you need to apologize to boss and Jermaine. He didn't want to apologize to either or. And everybody's just like, what did this man do to you to make you upset? Because that's not you, Max. That's not you. What's going on? I'm just like, you know, I can't stand people being disrespectful to people. And somebody needs to speak up and pull their card. That was it. So the next year I didn't go to the Dominican because I was actually in China. And I got Terrence Shannon, Corey Bradford, Keith, and JB sitting there telling stories about me from different places where I've gone ahead and somebody's flipped that switch on me in games. And they're like, yeah, Max is the nicest guy, but don't rub it the wrong way, because then all of a sudden we see that other person.
And so did that kid ever apologize? Did he
never apologize, wow. Be heard from ever again.
Just disappeared.
We don't even know if he got on the plane to go back to Canada.
Wow.
To Montreal. Yeah.
Wow.
That was it.
That's insane. Hey, let's do a quick lightning round with you, if you don't mind. It's just a one or two word answer, some questions Zach's going to ask. Zach, are you ready to ask the questions?
I am. And my first one is, who coined the nickname E-Money and why?
Greg McCabe, when I was in college. Finance major. My man G and I, we used to be G and E-Money Inc. And we'd actually do our projects together. And with the battlegrounds, they called. I wasn't home, and my younger brother answered the phone, and they're just like, well, what's his nickname? And he said, E Money. And they said, why E Money? Because E always gets money. So there you go. Shout out to my little brother, Chris.
I love it. Who's your toughest cover as a player? The one guy you just couldn't figure out how to guard?
Lamont Murray.
Okay.
Oh, good choice.
That's a great choice. Name.
Yeah.
I played against Lamont. I was fresh out of school, coming off of my first meniscal surgery, meniscectomy. And I'm talking about I was draped. I'm all this in his face. And Lamont shot from behind his head way back here. And Lamont's sitting there cashing out. He's like, look, I've never shot like this ever before. And we played the next week, and I went ahead and cooked him too. But I went ahead and got roasted. I was mad for the next 2 weeks until I played against him the next week. So, you know, he's really my toughest coverage.
That's awesome. I think Tony Farmer told us some Lamont stories. His name's come up a few times. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Any weird superstitions that you or a teammate had that come to mind?
Weird superstitions. I don't really have anything weird. I mean, I normally just in general, I'll go ahead and put my right foot, my right shoe on before my left. If not, I'll go ahead and take everything off and get dressed again.
That's a superstition.
Yeah. But the weird thing is, as I've gotten older, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So it's kind of weird. You know, earlier in my career, that was very much like that. As I got older, it's just like, look, I'm just going to go hoop. So it doesn't matter.
That's awesome. Favorite country you lived in and why?
I would say between Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, because they pay it on time.
There you go.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. So it'd be those that, because they paid on time. Other places like Argentina, I liked Argentina because they have really great steak.
Okay. Awesome. You're in incredible shape. I mean, you're still playing your 40s. What's a secret or word of advice that you'd give to others to take care of your body to be able to perform at a high level?
I never drank, never smoked, pray daily, and do everything within moderation.
Perfect.
Great advice.
My final one, I ask everybody this. It's a loaded question, but what's your favorite basketball memory if you had to pick just one?
Well, basketball paved the way, but I'd say being the first in my family to have a 4-year degree.
Nice.
Awesome.
Nice.
And
it's a hard one, right? I mean, there's a lot of memories.
Yeah. I think I would say probably playing for the Saints and playing for the Nelson Giants was interesting. Just due to just kind of the awkwardness of with the Saints, we had some really good chemistry, you know, on the team, but at the same time, we were very clicky, but we were very goal oriented. So that was like one of the teams where our focus was just so acute that we didn't let anything get in the way. And that's how we were back-to-back champs. And with Nelson, even though we lost in the finals, that was a couple years later, just, we had the focus, but the camaraderie was just completely different from really any other team that I had been on, because whether it was us on the team, because we used to fight, Mika Vrkona, Phil Jones, Josh Pace, myself, you know, we'd throw punches in practice and really didn't care. And then we'd all go out and eat 10 minutes later. And they never could understand why, you know, we were that way, but, you know, we just, you know, we heated, but off the court, it was really a family situation. You know, guys just, you know, you'd have kids with you and it's just, hey, you're with E for the next hour. You know, mom and I need to go, you know, do whatever, you know, and that was it. You know, which that made just playing that much easier and playing hard, you know, for everybody that much easier, because you really felt like it was just a close knit, you know, family. You know, but those would probably be like the big things that really jump out. I mean, individual accolades, I mean, they're cool. You know, they come with the job. But in terms of just like standing out, just really being just different, it'd be those two things.
Nice. Hey, is there anything you'd like to add or promote?
As far as for myself, I mean, I just, you know, we really got on the topic of men's health.
Right.
And being able to speak on that. And that's just really important to me because, you know, we are from that same generation to put some dirt on it, you know, put a little tape on it, and you know, you're good.
Yeah.
But you know, being able to really advocate and speak on, you know, just the fact that, because, you know, mental health is, I think, overused nowadays, but really the behind side of things of what mental health actually means, right?
Yeah.
Being able to speak about, you know, the real issues that are, you know, going on, you know, men have, I think, a different role in terms of, you know, how we live, whether, you know, we're single, we're married, you know, single with kids, you know, whatever it may be. But the issues that we have are all the same issues. You know, how do we provide? How do we support? How do we protect? Right. Those are all things that, you know, we really look at, and being able to have those safe places and have that understood, you know, on a more, you know, public stage, I think that's really what people need to focus on. And, you know, I'm just thankful that, you know, having the opportunity to, you know, speak with both of you guys, and, you know, even with yourself, Eric, you know, living with diabetes. So, and being able to relate and know exactly what it is, you know, you're just doing great things. And I think that's what, you know, people need to really, you know, just embrace, is, you know, the fact that, you know, these are things that need to be vocalized and put out there.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate you today. I mean, the conversations that we had, I think, were awesome. There's so much basketball knowledge, you know, we got to learn today, which is great, great stories. The overseas stories were amazing. I just really enjoyed the conversation. Zach, is there anything you'd like to add before we get out of here?
Yeah, I just want to say thanks for your time, man. I mean, this was a special one, not just for basketball, but also for, you know, you diving into the Crohn's. You know, I really appreciate you sharing all that, especially having a family member who has it. So that was a lot of fun. And even though I didn't realize that you're on the cover of Battleground, I promise I'm a big fan. So
I think you can buy it on Amazon for like $2 now.
Yeah. Well, either way, I really appreciate you, man. This was a lot of fun today. So thanks for your time.
No, I just, you know, I appreciate you guys having me on board. And the other thing with, you know, your family member having Crohn's, you know, the best part of advice, I know, you know, Eric can, you know, definitely, you know, back me up on this, is just being willing to listen, you know, and being able to listen candidly as far as what they're going through. Because a lot of times we're in situations where we may speak to a doctor and a doctor doesn't listen. You know, and they're trying to tell us and dictate what it is that's going on, but we're telling them these are our symptoms, because we're very in tune with our body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so being, you know, a supportive family member, being a supportive friend, being a supportive, you know, significant other, is just being able to just listen, because they'll tell you everything that they need to know, that they want you to know, as long as you're willing to listen. And if you have questions, to ask questions, you know, and to be able to say, you know, this might sound dumb, this might sound stupid, but I don't understand what this might be or what you're going through or what you're experiencing. Can you, you know, share more? And if you actually ask those type of questions, the information you're going to receive in return is probably going to be tenfold, because somebody knows that it's a safe place and that you actually, you know, care.
Yeah. That's huge, because I know with my situation, it's like, people, like, I haven't experienced cancer, right? Other than, you know, friends of mine that have had it and passed away from it, unfortunately. So I can't talk about it, right? Like, I don't understand. So I can't say to you, oh, I understand what you're going through. That's the big, you know, the big one where it's like, I want to understand what you're going through.
Right.
But I can't tell you I understand what you're going through, because I don't go through what you're going through, right? Mm-hmm. And that's huge. So to be able to be a listener, I mean, it's a great point, because it helps you become more educated on whatever the person's talking about, whatever it could be, you know, diabetes, Crohn's, autism, any, you know, anything. But it's listening, really, which we don't do enough in this country. We don't listen enough. We're always trying to talk but not listen. If we listen more, I think communication would be so much better.
Yeah, I mean, that's a global, you know, issue, not just
I'm sure, but I only can speak of here.
right.
You can, though, because you've played in other countries, right? So you know, you know firsthand, right?
Yeah. There's also a book, it's called The Foul Bow, and it's a Crohn's book, but it's written from a male's perspective. And I think it can give you, you know, a better insight on how to, and regardless of what the illness is, it can be applied to it, But it's just the thoughts and the struggles that somebody goes through. And it's actually a very humorous book. And it's a quick read. It's like a quick 200 pages, whatever.
Right.
But the information that's there, it's because I actually had some of my family members read it and some of my friends read it. And they're just like, oh, these are the same things that you're speaking about. It's just coming from a different, you know, mouth.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and so it really allowed things to really settle in. So I had some people who I had passed it on to. It's like, hey, you know, I'd really appreciate it if you would read it. They didn't read it. And it's okay.
Sure.
But as far as with the relationships that I have with those people, there's a reason why there's struggle within those relationships. And then with the others, it actually pulled us closer together.
Absolutely. Because they're willing to listen and understand what you're going through more. And then Right. They can pass that on to other people. And it just keeps,
Right. Like
we talked about earlier, just keeps that, breaks that chain and just keeps that communication
Exactly.
going for sure. Thanks again for being on the show. Stay safe out there. We really appreciate how generous you were.
I appreciate it. You guys, you know, definitely stay safe as well.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
Yep. No problem.
What a great episode that was. I mean, Aaron was just so generous with his time. And honestly, you know, I love talking about basketball, but I also love talking about, you know, issues like mental health and, you know, charities, things that are, I think, important that we need to talk about more, and learning more about Crohn's disease, which I know a lot of people don't understand or know about. And, you know, it's just an amazing conversation. You know, it was just one of those ones that I'm always going to remember.
Yeah, and I just always love the ones that go beyond basketball. I know the James Donaldson ones stood out to me when we talked about the mental yep. health stuff. But, I mean, this one also went beyond basketball, which I really loved. But he had so many great basketball stories about, you know, the overseas game and wild ball and also battlegrounds. It was really cool to learn about that. And I wish I remembered he's on the cover.
Yeah.
That was I mean – to be fair, those 20 years ago, I just saw it on TV. I mean, I don't even remember seeing the cover. So
that had to have been one of the most magical answers I've ever heard from a guest.
Yeah. He's like, were you in the
DVD? Well, I was actually on the cover, dumbass.
Well, no, because I thought they had a Battlegrounds the year before he actually got into it. And I thought
yeah.
they had a DVD before then. I knew he was in one of them. I just didn't know he's in the.
Yeah, that was amazing. And that wild ball. I mean, that man, that goes up there with some of the more crazier stories we've heard in our show.
Oh yeah, 100%.
That was just mind-boggling, and like just the, you know, the ref, you know, the ref getting paid off and the dude jumping up, you know, running full speed at the guy, yelling in Hungarian and just drop kicking his ass. I mean, you know, you don't get those stories anywhere, but not in my house, folks. Just letting you know that. Also, learning that he played against Kobe.
That's dope.
In the ABCD camp, right? I think it was.
Yeah.
Just really great stories, man. And persevering. You know, that was another thing, too. Like, you know, going to Providence, going across the country. You know what I mean? He goes across the country to play college ball, which, trust me, going across the country just even to go to school is not easy. I did it. And then going overseas to play basketball, that's not easy either. It just shows you hard work and determination and controlling what you can only control. It makes a huge difference on how far you get in life, man. Speaking of that, I really, really appreciate everybody that's been downloading. I mean, our download numbers have been really, really good this last week and a half, 2 weeks, bigger than normal, which has been really nice to see. And it just shows that we're getting the word out there. People are enjoying the show. We got some really good guests coming up, and we've had some great guests. I mean, this season's been an amazing season, you know, and I'm really thankful for all you guys for listening, downloading, you know, spreading the word, helping us getting guests. I mean, we have guests reaching out to us more and more now. It's just it's a great time to be doing a basketball podcast, and I'm just grateful for you guys. So thank you so much for believing in the show and listening. It really does make a difference. Zach, is there anything you want to add before we get out of here?
Yeah, just big thanks to E-Money, Aaron Maxey, man. Just what a great guy. A lot of people don't know that we get to talk to these guys before and a little bit after we record the podcast. And Aaron was just so cool. He gave us so much time afterwards just sharing other stuff. And, you know, just truly a really great dude. I mean, I got to say, shout out to Coach Tracy for the guys that he's getting.
for the Redeem team and TBT, because he's not only getting good players, he's getting high character people, and that's important. And guys like Aaron Maxey, Chris Jones, Marquise Marshall, Keith Kloss, all the guys we've had, they've all been very high character, and I really appreciate them.
Yes, high character is huge, man, especially for you younger listeners. It's like you get to learn early on the mistakes you shouldn't make and the things that you can do to be, you know, just a well-rounded great person. And we appreciate people telling stories and giving back. It's enormous. So ladies and gentlemen, be good to yourselves, be good to others. Stay safe out there, and thanks for listening to the show. She's watching. That's funny. Thanks for listening to the show. Peace.
And shout out Jermaine Barnes.
Yes. Yes.